Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Midnight in the Philippine Sea. The ocean is warm, windless and flat, shining with the reflections of stars. Somewhere in that sea is a single speck. It's a pawpaw, a wooden dugout canoe. A single outrigger is lashed to its side for stability. A bedsheet sail hangs lifeless from its makeshift mast. Lying beneath that sail is a young man. He's half asleep, collapsed with exhaustion. A large heavy paddle is in his hand, trailing in the water. The paddle slips into the water. The man jerks awake and snatches as he feels it slip through his fingers. It's too late. The paddle sinks instantly. The man puts his hands to his face in despair and frustration. He spent days paddling on the open ocean, escaping from exile on an island thousands of kilometers from his home in Samoa. He looks out to the southwest and kneels on the floor of his canoe. He yanks out the wooden plank set across the hull as a seat. Then, using this plank as a makeshift paddle, he starts sculling forward again. The man in this pawpaw was Inga Pisa, and the story of this voyage is legendary among his family. But the rest of Inga's life story is just as fascinating. As a young Matai, a chief, his opposition to German rule of Western Samoa before the First World War saw him exiled thousands of kilometers from home. By the time he returned, the war was over, and Western Samoa was under the sway of a new colonial power, and he would find a career working alongside that regime. In the eyes of some, that career saw Inga Pisa become a traitor to his own people. Talo Falava, I'm Kuroi Hawkins. This is Untold Pacific History Season 2, and the story of Inga Pisa. Inga Pisa was born on Savai in 1882. He came from a senior family within the Whaha Matai, the traditional Samoan leadership system. He also came from a devoutly Christian family. Both his parents and his brother and sister decided to travel far from home, spreading the gospel.
His father is a Samoan Whaiheao, London Mission Society at the time. And his older brother, Sio, also went into the missionary work.
This is Whaha Fusuanga Masunu Tanapusi, Inga Pisa's eldest grandson. As Masunu explains, because the rest of his immediate family were busy with mission work, it was left to Inga to uphold the Matai title.
He was bestowed the title at a very young age, between 18 or 20 years old. I guess that's where he started his life in politics.
And it was a complex time for Samoa, politically speaking. From the middle of the 19th century onwards, Samoa had come under increasing pressure from three Western powers, the United States, Germany, and the British Empire. All three were interested in exploiting Samoa's natural resources and its strategically significant harbours, which could be used as coaling stations for steam-powered warships. The tensions between the three powers led them to support different factions within Samoan society in internal power struggles. By the 1880s, they were providing weapons and soldiers to fight in civil wars. At points during these conflicts, warships opened fire on Samoan villages, wreaking devastation. In 1889, when Iino was about 7 years old, warships from all three powers faced each other down in Apia Harbour. It seemed a full-scale battle was about to get underway. But then a hurricane tore through the harbour, sinking or severely damaging most of the ships and putting an end to the standoff. Ten years later, in 1899, the three powers came to an agreement which would have long-lasting impacts on Samoa, even to the modern day. History professor Damon Selesa explains.
Samoa's divided into two, and it's not divided into two in Samoa, it's divided into two in Europe, where the US gets, you know, the part that we know as American Samoa, and New Zealand, which had been trying to secure the western part, gives up its claim very unhappily, and the western part goes to Germany. And that's because Germany has a really large commercial interest in Western Samoa, plantations and a lot of settlers and who own these plantations. And out of that moment where we get a formal German government in the west and a formal US government in the east, that's the moment that Samoans begin to realise that actually their country, they've lost something about their country.
From 1899 onward, Samoa was split in two. The two largest islands of Upolu and Savai in the west became German Samoa, and the smaller islands to the east became American Samoa.
And so the Germans arrive in a much more different way, where they have soldiers and a police force, and they start passing laws that aren't just for Germans and white people, for Balangis, but actually they think that Samoans are going to... these laws are going to apply to Samoans. Quite quickly, there's a response to this German imposition of German colonial law. And there's many ways in which this is tackled. You know, Samoans simply don't listen to Germans. They don't pay taxes very well. They do things like play cricket, which, because it's a very English sport, is a resistance to the Germans. But eventually it all comes to a head. And it starts coming to a head as quickly as 4 years after the Germans take over.
This increasingly tense colonial context is where Iinga Pisa began his political life. He joined a coalition of leaders on Savai who opposed the expansion of German rule.
The visible leader of that effort is a man called Loaki Namalaulu Mamoe, and he uses his group of very powerful Tula Whaleo orators to consolidate a Samoan opposition. And that starts happening in 1907, 1908. And by 1908, it's become clear that there's this formal, traditional Samoan political opposition to the German government, especially strong in Savai, but increasingly expanding not just into Upolu, but also even looking further afield into American Samoa. And that becomes known as the Mau a Pule, the sort of will or the testament of Pule, this group of orators. And they become the sort of formal opposition to the German colonial government.
Vaafu Suanga Masunu Talapusi says it's no surprise his grandfather was swept up in the Mau a Pule.
Amoa, the district where he hails from, was basically the heart of the Mau a Pule. Lawaki, of course, the leader, is from Safotulafai, which is only a few villages down from Pua, where the Iinga title comes from. So I guess everything sort of centred around there.
Iinga was among the youngest members of the Mau a Pule, but he still had an important role.
He could write and read because of the whaiseau, the missionaries. So his whole idea was to record the minds of the chiefs. I mana foile to see if a mo maunga, if a mo maunga amatai, ima to ina. And I'm here to record the meetings and that sort of thing. I guess that's his role, and which Lawaki trusted him. Remember, in those days, writing and recording things is a Palangi thing.
Yeah, he's clearly a really strong supporter of Lauaki and is pivotal in their sort of effort to grow the support of the Māo outside of its core base of Savai. And he's the one that they actually send to American Samoa, which is a really powerful thing. So part of it, I think, is because he's quite young, which meant he was quite physically fit and capable, as we learn later on. So he goes to American Samoa, and that's actually what brings him to the attention of the Germans. And that was a big no-no to go outside of German Samoa, because at that point, the Germans are very vigilant about how the world sees them.
And when Inga returned to German-controlled territory, retribution was swift.
Early in the morning, the house was surrounded by chariots. I mean, horse carts. And he was asked to come and see the governor.
Inga was taken from his house to Waimea prison and locked up for 2 days before he appeared in court.
His court case was held at midnight. You know, they marched him from Waimea and with chains around his hands and his feet. And according to him, there were 6 soldiers with guns and him chained up.
Inga arrived at the courthouse to face a panel of German colonial and military authorities.
They were trying to break his spirit, basically intimidated him by the side saying, if you do not obey, they're going to shoot you or something. And Inga said, I'm not scared. I'm going to speak the truth. Basically, the whole court case was, did you go to America, to American Samoa to get firearms for the Māo and get support from the American government, Samoa, American Samoa? And Inga said, no, I am with the Māo and here to look after the elders. They couldn't break his spirit.
Tensions in Samoa were reaching a head. Damon Salesa says at first, the Mauapule moved quietly.
So a lot of it takes place where the Germans can't see it. It takes place in Funo, it takes place in Malanga, it takes place in wherever Samoans gather. And because there's so few German officials, they can't actually see what's going on until it rears its head at really big, large-scale gatherings.
The wake-up call came at public events and gatherings featuring both Governor Solf and Lauaki, where Lauaki was clearly treated as the more important figure by ordinary Samoans.
The Germans are consistently worried that at any given moment, the natives, as they see them, could tip from giving speeches to being violent. And, you know, it had only been not even 10 years since Samoans were last at war with each other. You know, many of these Samoan men were experienced warriors. They had guns, and there were more Samoans with guns than there were Germans. You can see their fear. But Lauaki actually was not after that. The way he wanted to pursue was a much more peaceful or non-violent resistance. Yeah. But the threat of violence was there, at least in the Germans' mind.
The threat sat uneasily in Governor Solf's mind, and eventually he decided to call in the big guns.
He called in the most powerful navy that existed in the Pacific at that time, the Asiatic Squadron of the German Navy, and they came from China. And then they essentially parked between Upolu and Savai'i, parked between the two Samoan islands to stop traditional travel between them, and then pointed guns at Samoan villages. These are big, like, huge guns that would flatten Samoan villages.
Looking down the barrels of these warships, Lauaki remembered the wars of the late 1800s, conflicts where naval artillery had laid waste to Samoan villages.
At which point he decided for the good of Samoa that he would let them exile him. Now there was another option, which was, you know, so strong was their support, they could have triggered quite a different response, which would have led to enormous loss of particularly Samoan life, but probably not only Samoan lives.
So Lauaki and the other leaders of the Mauapule chose exile over war. 12 Matai, along with some of their family members, were taken aboard the SMS Jaguar, a German gunboat, Inga Pisa among them. the Germans got ready to depart. But there was a problem.
They couldn't pull the anchor up. It got stuck there for several days, and they had to bring in another warship with the welders and all that to cut the chain, to cut the anchor and sail. So to us, we feel that God is not with this. God is going to bring these people back. There is a reason why they were stuck there.
The stranded warship sat just off the coast. Inga watched people paddle out to Jaguar, shouting encouragement to the exiles.
He could see some of his relatives paddling. He could hear them yell out, "Famarosi, Famarosi, Inga, God is with you," and you know.
Eventually, the anchor was cut free and the Jaguar set sail. Inga wrote that he suffered terrible seasickness on the first few days of the voyage. He said the captain of the Jaguar took pity on him, giving him an atlas so he could see where he was being taken. That book would come in handy a few years later. After 21 days sailing, the Jaguar arrived at its destination, Saipan, the largest island of the Northern Marianas and another German colony. The sheer distance from Saipan to Samoa meant the Germans didn't need to go through the expense and trouble of keeping the exiles locked up. Instead, the Samoans set up their own self-sufficient community in Saipan.
So far away from Samoa, there's no way that they can make their way back.
Tili Afamasanga is a Samoan educator and historian and a descendant of Inga.
Apparently, they started growing their own bananas and their own taro, but they lived more or less like their own village. And so their everyday life would probably be centered around finding food, cooking food, growing food, and doing things like that.
Inga Pisa himself wrote about his life on Saipan in a memoir. Parts of it were published in the Marianas Variety newspaper in 1972, about a decade after Inga had passed away.
Saipan was a good place. It produced an abundance of foodstuffs the same as those in Samoa. We were provided with all our needs by the German in charge of that island, and the village was built around 11 good fale.
So life in Saipan wasn't as harsh as the exiles may have feared. But Inga was determined to return to Samoa. He said that within a few months of arriving in Saipan, he began to prepare for that moment.
In August 1909, it entered my mind that I ought to attend the German school conducted by the government, for I realized clearly my ignorance of the German government and lack of education had handicapped me in the part I took in the Samoan strivings against the authority of that government, and had brought me the same punishment as the older Samoan chiefs.
He thought this was a good moment to learn German, and that when he went back to German Samoa, that he might be able to then get a job for the colonial government and might be able to get on with things for the benefit of his family.
So this seems to signal a change in Inga Pisa. At first, he'd aligned himself with the Mauapule, which resisted the colonial system from the outside. But now in exile, he says he saw the benefit of working within the colonial system. Maybe, as Damon Salesa suggests, Inga was thinking about himself and his immediate family, how to maintain their safety, wealth, and social position living under a colonial regime. Or maybe Inga believed he could work from within the colonial government to limit its negative impact on Samoa. It's impossible to know Inga's inner feelings more than 100 years after the fact. This is all just speculation. Whatever he was thinking, 5 years after arriving in Saipan in 1914, Inga's plans were turned upside down.
The First World War begins, and the German colonies in the Pacific are the first to go.
Holding Western Samoa and a handful of other island colonies was far from Germany's first priority in the war, and it didn't put much effort into defending them. About a month after war broke out, on August 29th, New Zealand troops landed in Western Samoa. The handful of German soldiers and officials in Apia surrendered without a fight. The German flag came down, the Union Jack went up. Two months later, a different Allied power would arrive in Saipan, and Inga Pisa was there to see it.
It was in October 1914 that a Japanese warship carrying 900 men arrived in Saipan, seized the island from Germany and hoisted the Japanese flag.
And just in case you're confused, remember, this is the First World War. It wasn't until the Second World War that the Japanese would fight alongside Germany.
After a few days, the German officials of Saipan were taken to Tokyo for internment. The Japanese at once erected great radio masts on the hills, telephones around the island, and installed troops in occupation.
For Inga and the other exiles, a lot had changed in a very short time.
What's German Samoa becomes New Zealand or British Samoa, and what's German Micronesia becomes Japanese. And so he's actually by this time become quite a good German speaker. He can read and write and speak German. And then all of a sudden the Japanese are there in Saipan, and they bring in, instead of German schools, you've got Japanese schools, and he decides he doesn't want to learn Japanese, that it won't be useful back in Samoa.
Within a few days of his arrival, the new Japanese governor came to speak with the exiles. Inga Pisa said they welcomed him in traditional Samoan fashion, with feasting and dancing.
One of our group made a speech and expressed thanks that the Japanese had removed the Germans by direction of King George of Great Britain.
Inga said the exiles immediately asked the governor to send them home.
The governor said he would transmit our wish to Tokyo, thence to King George V in Great Britain and to New Zealand, which by then had taken over Western Samoa. He said if the requests were approved, he would provide a ship to take us all to Samoa.
Most of the exiles were excited about the possibility of returning home, but Inga wasn't among them.
I became worried immediately with the thought that if I returned to Samoa with our other people, I should have to live back in my village, for I did not know the English language, which would be requisite now that New Zealand had taken over control of Western Samoa. The German language, which I struggled to learn in order to assist my ambitions, was now useless. I also felt it was of little use as to return to Samoa until the war ended and it became certain which government would rule in Western Samoa.
So at this point, Inga made an extraordinary decision.
I thought at once of going to the United States Naval Station at Guahan.
Guahan is the original Chamorro name for Guam. The island had been seized from Spain by the United States in 1898 after the Spanish-American War. At Guam, Inga thought he could find someone to teach him English, and knowing that language, he'd be better placed to find a job when he finally did return home. But travelling to Guam was easier said than done.
It was over 100 miles from Saipan, and how would I get there?
Luckily for Inga, there was a group of people on Saipan who could help him.
The Samoans who are living in Saipan are living alongside these great mariners. I mean, the Micronesians are the truly great mariners of the modern era in the Pacific. They build their canoes in Saipan like they would in Samoa. So they build the paupau, the kind of canoes every Samoans and Tongans know well. So they're, you know, what are they, about 14 or 16 feet, 4 or 5 metres long. He takes one of those and decides he's going to paddle from Saipan to Guam, which is, you know, about 200 kilometres.
Inga had already borrowed a paupau from the Chamorro people to go fishing off the coast of Tinian, an island just a few kilometres south of Saipan. So shortly after the Japanese arrived, he took his paupau to a Chamorro community at the southernmost tip of Saipan.
I stayed on that side of our island with a friend and put together some foodstuffs, coconuts and a few bottles of water, secured the lashings of the outrigger of the boat and fashioned a sail from a bed sheet. I planned to travel first to Tinian by way of trial for the longer journey ahead.
Slowly, cautiously, Inga tested out his pawpaw with its makeshift sail.
I arrived at Tinian in the afternoon. From there, I now saw another island.
This island was Aguihan, a speck of land about 10 kilometers south of Tinian. Inga sailed towards it.
My pawpaw arrived there after nightfall, and I could not find a place to beach my boat. I went around to the side, sheltered from the wind, and rested there.
As he rested, Inga gathered his determination.
The moon rose about 8 p.m., and I decided at once that I should proceed to Guahan.
So far, on his short voyage from Saipan to Tinian and Ahujan, Inga Pisa hadn't left sight of land. The next leg of his voyage was more ambitious and more dangerous. Roughly 80 kilometers of open ocean separated Inga from Rota, the next island in the chain between Saipan and Guam. That was an easy day's sailing for a larger vessel, but a mammoth voyage for one man in a small canoe.
The moon rose, and then a light breeze sprang up, causing only a ripple on the ocean. My pawpaw skimmed along with the wind while I steered with the paddle.
Aguihan vanished behind him. In all directions, Inga could see nothing but the ocean.
I had pondered what I should use as a compass at night and remembered that the stars called the Southern Cross remained in the southern part of the sky. The sun was my compass by day, for the Mariana Islands are spread out in a line from north to south. The southernmost is Guahan, so my course by day had to go through that of the sun moving from east to west.
Inga Pisa had one more navigational tool, the atlas he'd been gifted by the captain of the Jaguar. Looking at that atlas must have been daunting. If he drifted off course by just a few degrees, Inga could sail straight past his destination and never see it appear above the horizon.
When morning dawned, I was unable to see any island, only the heavens and the sea. I prayed to God, confessing and apologizing to him, thinking that perhaps I had rebelled against his authority in trying to cross the ocean in such a small boat.
The wind failed. Inga had to start paddling.
I prayed that I may see an island. I did not want to die in the sea. Let me die on any kind of island, whether inhabited or not.
The sun passed overhead and set once again.
I did not rest day or night, but paddled my craft continuously and strongly, holding to the thought that if death should take me, it should take me after my strength had finished.
He paddled through the night and into the following morning, then all through the next day and into the night once more.
After 3 days and nights had passed, I saw an island appear. It was a calm afternoon and the sea was like a still pool. I thought this to be Guahan, and paddled hard with my remaining strength. But when darkness came, I had not arrived, and my eyes could no longer see the island. My hands were swollen from cold and the continuous paddling.
Inga was exhausted. He had to rest, just for a moment. He lay down in the hull of the pawpaw, his hand on the paddle, his eyes closed.
Soon I felt the paddle slipping through my fingers into the sea. It was lost in the darkness and probably sank. It was made of a timber which does not float. For this first time, I submitted to fear and cried aloud to be heard from the shore.
There was no reply. Inga sat alone in the darkness, less than 10 kilometers from shore.
Having no help, and knowing that the wind would soon come up again and my death would be the result, I took a piece of board I was sitting on and lashed it to a stick in an endeavor to use it as a paddle.
The lashing came loose, and in the end, Inga just used the board by itself, holding it in two hands and sculling forward. He paddled like this for 6 hours.
The cocks were crowing as I landed. I drew my boat up onto a beach, went inland a little way, and soon fell asleep in a cave.
Inga was woken a few hours later by heavy footsteps and a shocked yell.
A native of the island came by with his son. They were riding in a cart drawn by an ox, as is their custom. The man was startled when his son called out and pointed to me lying in the cave.
Luckily, Inga had learned enough of the Chamorro language to talk with the man. He was given some food and taken to see the principal chief.
The chief received me with great kindness and sent some of the islanders to bring my baobao round to the settlement. He provided me with food after the manner of the hospitable customs of Samoa.
But Inga Piso was in for a shock. The chief told him that this was not his destination. He wasn't in Guam. He'd landed on Rota Island, about halfway between Saipan and Guam. Inga said the chief of Rota offered to help him sail back the way he had come. But he refused. Despite his brush with disaster, he was still determined to reach Guam.
I wrote to our people that they could take passage to Samoa when a warship came for them, but without myself. I had no intention of turning back, but would proceed to Guahan, as was my ambition. Someday, I would find my way back to Samoa.
But he was still exhausted from his voyage. He stayed with the chief for a few more days to regain his strength.
The chief of Rota was a carpenter who owned many tools. With them, I fashioned a new paddle of ifilele, which is the most common wild tree throughout the Marianas. From a hilltop, I could just see just a little of the hills of Guahan, about 54 miles away to the southeast. On Thursday of the following week, I told the chief I was leaving for Guahan. He said that I could not do it, that I would perish in the sea, for in all history of this island, no one had made the journey in a small craft such as mine.
Inga replied that Guam was closer to Rota than Rota was to Saipan, and he made that voyage successfully. The chief might have replied that yes, Inga had made it, but he'd very nearly died in the attempt. But instead, he helped the young man gather supplies and fix his sail.
It was about 7 p.m. when I said farewell to the chief and to Rota. Again, I set my course by the Southern Cross, which stood out brilliantly in the direction where Guahan lay. My canoe sailed along under pressure of my bed sheet sail.
Thankfully, this next leg of Inga's voyage was less dramatic. The wind held, and he landed at Guam at about 1 o'clock the following afternoon.
When he arrives, he is taken to the governor of Guam, who's a US naval governor. And what's interesting is that the only two parts of the Pacific that are ruled by the US Navy are Guam and American Samoa. And the governor of Guam at the time had actually been in Samoa before and was there at the really famous hurricane in 1889 and recognises Inga as a Samoan and then sort of takes an interest in him, gives him a job where Inga learns not just English but also printing.
Inga Pisa lived and worked in Guam from June 1915 until after the war ended in 1918. That year, he took a steamship from Guam to Honolulu, where he lived for another 5 months, waiting for permission to return home to Samoa. Then finally, in September 1919, Inga arrived home in Samoa. The island had changed fundamentally since he'd left, and Inga had changed too. In fact, he changed so much that when he arrived back in Sabai, nobody recognised him.
Part of the reason he says that is, you know, he's wearing trousers and he's, you know, a shirt and he's wearing a hat. So he's probably a bit of a fancy guy. You know, he was a very well-travelled man, if you think about the world at that time. He brought with him a depth and breadth of experience that not many Samoans had.
By now, Iingapisa was in his late 30s. As well as his native Samoan, he could now also speak German and English. And that triple fluency made him a very valuable individual for the new rulers of Western Samoa.
I mean, if you imagine New Zealand stepping in at that point in 1914 quite rapidly, one of the challenges they face immediately is that most of the people who can speak German are immediately under suspicion as being German sympathisers or nationals or married to Germans. And so what you have is a government being replaced by another group of people who don't speak that language, and all the records, everything is in German. And so the people who are able to speak what are effectively the three languages of Samoa, German, English and Samoan, become very influential people.
But Iinga's value wasn't just as a translator.
Iinga's not just anyone who speaks three languages. He's someone who has a deep understanding of Samoan culture, Samoan people, and then knows so many of the most important people in Samoa. And so that is as much as an asset as the language capability.
At the time Iinga took up this role as the secretary of the Samoan Native Department, the New Zealand regime was in desperate need of his help. The year before Iinga returned to Samoa, the 1918 influenza pandemic swept around the globe and devastated Western Samoa. It's estimated this pandemic killed about 20% of the population, the highest death rate anywhere in the world. New Zealand officials got a lot of the blame for this catastrophe. Authorities failed to maintain a quarantine in Apia. They also rejected or failed to respond to offers of help from doctors in nearby American Samoa. Anger and grief among the Samoan population helped generate a new resistance movement. It was formally established in 1927, about 10 years after the pandemic, and became known as Olemau a Samoa, the firm opinion of the people of Samoa. As Vaafusuanga Masunu Talapusi points out, there must have been a bit of deja vu for Iinga.
He actually went through two Maus. The Mau Pule, being the Mau from Savai, and then the Mau of the late 20s.
But while this second Mau movement shared some aspirations with the Mau Pule, which Iinga Pisa had joined as a young man, he chose not to associate with this new movement.
He was quite active at the time with the colonial, with New Zealand, when the Mau started. So, he's quite often called upon to break up the demonstrations or a solo or something like that when he was living at Muninu'u. So, yeah.
The question is why? Given his previous association with the Mau Apule, it seemed natural for Iinga to support the new Mau. But he didn't. He kept his job as secretary of the Samoan Native Department. Tiliafa Masanga says Iinga never fully explained his decision in his diaries or manuscripts.
But I think he probably felt, well, you know, he had done the best that he could. And now perhaps other people should continue that kind of struggle.
Tiliafa Masanga says Iinga may have felt caught between his responsibilities. After all, by joining the Mau, he would risk being exiled again.
He was a Matai, still a Matai, doing all his duties. He only had one brother and one sister. His older brother was a Whaifiau. His sister had been with the missionaries, but she had died coming back from Great Britain. He was the one who had to have the responsibility of all the families. You know, all the family obligations had to be his responsibilities. It would have been a very difficult position for the old man to be in, really.
Another of Iinga's descendants, Niofolau Fautu Talapusi, points out there were divisions among Samoans over whether to support the Mau.
There were people that said, yeah, e ka kaunga, e ka ngā kai kongo to fight for, you know, our rights. Yeah. And then others were like, no, because they're not doing anything for the people of Samoa. Assuming because Iinga was there, he was of the former lot that believed that change could be made from the inside.
And as Damon Salesa points out, Iinga was far from the only Samoan to work alongside the New Zealanders.
It's easy to see these things in black and white, but once you start seeing that, well, not all Samoans were on the same page, that there were, you know, if there weren't Samoans working with the colonial government, there's no question that it would have been even more brutal. To understand that everyone has their own trajectory, just like today, you know, at the end of the day, we all have to look after our families and eat, and that many of us would take and have taken jobs that if we followed the whole logic through, don't align with our deeply held values. You know, so the world was no less complex back then.
This role was clearly a difficult one. Vaafu Suanga Masunu Talapusi says one time when Iinga was at home sick, a government car pulled up outside his house. So Iinga got into the car and drove out to meet the Mau protesters.
As he walked off from the vehicle towards there, people were calling him Judas, you know, Rome Falata, Ekta, you know, so everybody feel that they were betrayed by him. Naturally, people would react that way, and I would have said the same too.
Perhaps the most testing moment in this chapter of Iinga's life came on Saturday, 28 December 1929. On this day, New Zealand police opened fire on a crowd of Samoan protesters, killing at least 9 Samoans, including the Mau leader, Tupua Tamasese Lealofi III. We've discussed this massacre in more depth in a previous episode of Untold Pacific, but in short, the killing started when New Zealand police attempted to arrest several Mau members in the middle of a peaceful march. Some members of the crowd resisted. The police opened fire with revolvers, and the crowd responded by throwing stones and beating one of the policemen to death. Officers retreated to the police station, and gunmen on the roof opened fire on the crowd. Iinga Fisa wasn't there to see these events unfold, but as his great-granddaughter Niofolau Fautu Talapusi explained in a discussion with her cousin Silingasani Muleaumasealii, he played a role in the aftermath.
When the whole event happened with Tamasese being shot, Iinga was asked to go and try and calm down our people because there was like a lot of unrest, a lot of anger and people being upset. So
I can see people on either side
being like, okay, that's great, or no, he shouldn't have. But I believe he really believed that he was in a moment in time when he was trying to make the best, you know, with what he had or what he knew.
That'd be everything to everybody.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. Exactly.
And Damon Salesa says it's important to keep the wider picture in mind when thinking about Iinga's role with the government.
So it's a kind of classic situation where if you do understand the impacts that policies will have, you will better understand how to work either against them or how to mitigate some of their harms. And there were no Samoans working for the colonial government who wanted harm for Samoans. I mean, there were plenty who wanted to advance their own particular interests, and that's as true of Iinga as anyone else. But they always operate with those double vision. They're both what they need to do for their job, which is important to them and supports their family, even though it's about colonialism. But also, you know, these are their people. These are their communities. This is their village and their Iinga. So they're always got that double vision, which, you know, non-Samoan people don't have. I mean, that's just the way, that's a simple truth.
Inga would spend much of the rest of his life working for the Samoan Native Department, eventually retiring in 1942. By this time, he'd married, had children and grandchildren. He'd also developed a chronic medical condition, elephantitis, which caused his legs to swell painfully with fluid. Elephantitis is caused by a parasitic infection from mosquito bites.
And I guess it was a result of the voyage, him being eaten alive by mosquitoes in the sea.
Vafusuanga Masunu Talapusi's strongest memory of his grandfather is helping to massage Inga's swollen legs, listening to the old man give advice and tell stories.
I remember he used to sing a song to put me to sleep, and it goes like this. Ia le masunu, le masunu, sunu, sunu. Ia le masunu, le masunu, sunu, sunu. That's a song they said, my mom said, that he used to sing to put me to sleep. So I try and sing it to my children. it's my favorite memory of him.
About 20 years after Inga's retirement, a breakthrough moment came for Western Samoa.
January the 1st, 1962. And with the new year comes the first independent Polynesian state of the 20th century, Western Samoa.
After years of painstaking negotiations involving Inga Pisa and many other leaders, Samoa won its independence. Unfortunately, Inga couldn't watch the ceremony unfold.
He was sick. He couldn't go to Murinu. But if you recall, in those days, everything was on the transistor radio.
Inga Pisa listened as the independence ceremony unfolded.
For the last time, the two trusteeship flags are lowered, one by the Prime Minister of New Zealand and the other by the Honourable Mataafa Fiame, Prime Minister of Western Samoa.
And he did wrote down in one of his last entries, Watuturu o uroi mata o re fifia. I guess if you translate that, is I've shed a tear of joy listening to the sound of freedom.
Slowly and surely, in a moment of deep emotion, the heads of state raise the emblem of Western Samoa to the masthead, where, like the flag of many another new independent state, it demonstrates with dignity the fulfillment of a people's wish.
That's one of his last entry in his diary, because he was quite sick.
Inga Pisa was born in a free and independent Samoa. In his lifetime, he saw the rise and fall of two colonial regimes, first the Germans, then the New Zealanders. He travelled all across the Pacific, from Samoa to Saipan to Guam to Honolulu, and back to Samoa once more. He also visited Aotearoa in his time working for the Department of Native Affairs. He was the only member of the Mauapule who lived to see Samoan independence. In fact, of all the Mao leaders exiled to Saipan, Inga was the only one who lived to return to Samoa at all. Inga Pisa himself died in 1965. He was 82 years old. You're listening to Untold Pacific History Season 2, and I'm your host, Koroi Hawkins. This episode was produced by William Ray and was made with the support of New Zealand On Air. The interviews in this episode were provided by Tiki Lounge Productions, thanks to Lisa Tauma and Tuki Laumea. Special thanks to Ngā Taonga Kōrero, Sound and Vision, for supplying the archive recordings. Executive producer is Tim Watkin. Thanks to Phil Benj, our sound engineer, for this episode. Voice acting was by Silinga Sania Muleoma Sealii. You can watch the Untold Pacific History series on YouTube or the RNZ podcast and series page at rnz.co.nz. You can find this and other episodes in this series on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this, please subscribe and give us a rating so that others can find it.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.